Coming up today, monkey self-awareness, the return of a Nokia classic, perhaps, and the 10 biggest threats facing civilization today. You're listening to episode 305 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Jeremy White.
Hello.
We should start the show this week by trying to direct you towards the second series in our Future Cities programme, which focuses on Israel and Palestine. There are five 20-minute episodes. The first one is online now. It's brilliant. It's really, really interesting. We look beyond the sort of well-known scene in Tel Aviv to the wider region, East Jerusalem, Ramallah, and the West Bank, to understand what's really going on there.
There's lots going on. Absolutely.
There is a lot going on. It's fascinating. And here's a clip.
Everybody's an engineer in Israel. I mean, we don't really have anything else to do here. If you're in the desert, you have to invent something, right? We don't have a lot of natural resources, so that's our resource, innovation.
Gaza is amongst the most innovative that I've seen. You know, when the fuel shortages start, they start running their cars on cooking oil. I think because of the closure, because of the repeated shocks of conflict, they're innovating to survive.
To watch the first episode in full, head to wired.co.uk/video. There'll be a new episode uploaded every week. And let us know what you think on Twitter at WiredUK. Jeremy, you were nearly sick in a car this week. What happened?
I was.
Terrible driving?
It was terrible driving. Terrifying driving, actually. This week, I went to Portugal, the Estoril racetrack, to try out the fastest four-seater car in the world. It's Bentley's new Continental Supersports. Now, the Supersports is their racing sort of inspired range that they've been producing for over 90 years. And the last one was some 8 years ago. So these come along only occasionally. And then when they come along, they're quite special. This latest iteration is certainly that. It is a 3-ton car that can propel itself in 3.4 seconds from 0 to 60. For that weight, that is a phenomenal achievement. It's a 700 brake horsepower engine they've managed to squeeze into this.
So to prove the point, they got you a bit giddy by rocketing you around a track.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the world's best driver. I'm perfectly willing to accept that. So what I decided to do, rather than drive round the track myself, Top Gear style, trying to do a piece to camera about the innovations about all the car and what it can do. For example, one of the really cool things is the fact that each wheel is strong enough to lift a small city car on its own. It has the largest brakes of any commercially available car as well, because it's so huge. So the braking needs to be so severe for such a huge car. Anyway, so I decided, well, I won't do this. What I'll do, as we have right here, the 2003 Le Mans winner, Guy Smith, let's get him to drive me around the track while I try and explain what's great about the car. That was a mistake.
He decided to show off.
He showed off. He did. He bloody did. And I needed a new pair of trousers at the end of it.
And people will be able to watch the video when it's online next week, hopefully.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, you should watch it. It's you know, it's rather embarrassing for me, you know, but it does show what the car can do. It's a phenomenal machine.
It can make Jeremy scream like a scared child. A thing you've learnt this week, Matt Burgess.
I have learnt that a parrot could open 12 bottle caps in 1 minute, and the parrot's name was Gordon, and he's the parrot that has been able to open the most bottles in a minute.
In a minute.
Well done. The
was
latest
strong
in
competition. Is it strong competition? Was it?
It was. It trained for more than a year.
The latest in Matt Burgess's, oh dear, I need to think of a fact, and looking at the Guinness World Book of Records. Jeremy, what did you learn this week?
I learned something which coffee drinkers might want to be aware of this if you're not already. There is a drug in grapefruit juice or in grapefruits called naringin or naringin. And this has been proven to show that it inhibits the body's natural breakdown of caffeine in the intestine. So it keeps caffeine in the body for longer. So what you could do is have a really strong espresso in the morning to wake yourself up. And instead of having three or four over the course of the morning, to try and keep you on that sort of caffeine high. What some sort of, you know, as a life hack almost, what some people do is have a glass of grapefruit juice as well, which then extends the life of caffeine in the body, meaning you can, you get the high, but without the multiple cups.
It's a bit grim though, isn't it?
What's grim about it?
Well, there's something nice about enjoying a nice cup of coffee and then having to do a grapefruit juice chaser, essentially.
That's true. Okay, say you know you're going somewhere where you're going to have really crap coffee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but you can you've got one shot at a really nice coffee, then you can sort of like, well, I don't want any more of that shit.
Life hacks from Jeremy White. Yeah. Coffee and grapefruits. I have a head scratcher for you. So if you could drive a car straight upwards at 60 miles an hour, it would take about an hour to get to the edge of space. Space is about 50 miles above the air, above the Earth. So how long would it take you to drive to the moon?
This is continuous driving.
Yep.
I'm going
continually at 60 miles an hour straight up.
No toilet breaks.
I mean, you've got an RV, say, so you've got a bathroom on board. There's not much driving to do, I guess. You could put it in autopilot.
Okay, I'm going to say 3 weeks. That's a complete guess.
It's thousands of miles.
Do you want the distance? Would that help?
Yeah, I would actually.
400,000 kilometers. Yeah. You're welcome to guess again.
Exactly. I'd say for something like 3 years or something ridiculous.
27 years.
27. That's a long time. Yeah, it's about 6 months. So it's the equivalent of driving 10 times around the Earth, ish. So if you could, then that's how long it would take.
Now that's a situation where some grapefruit juice and coffee would come in very handy, I would say.
And you need a lot of it earlier as well.
Okay, our first story of the week. What do humans, great apes, orcas, bottlenose dolphins, Asian elephants, and Eurasian magpies have in common?
Is this a question for us?
No, not really. They can all, unlike any other animals studied, recognize themselves in the mirror. So, in short, they have exhibited a type of self-awareness. But we might need to add another animal to that list after rhesus monkeys passed the mirror self-recognition test in a series of controlled experiments.
How does this test work? Is it something that's done for every animal?
Well, they're doing it on more and more animals, and they found that it is quite a select group. But this might begin to change based on this study. So what you do is you put a odorless, non-irritant dot on the face of an animal and then place the animal in front of a mirror. And if it touches the dot on its head rather than touching the mirror...
This is how they do this in babies as well, by the way.
And you are a father, so you will have seen your child, children.
Yeah, my son. This is exactly how they do it when they work out whether they're self-aware or not. You put a bit of dot on their forehead or like one of those hole punches... You know, from a piece of paper, and it's whether they grab that or grab the mirror. If they're grabbing the mirror, they don't recognize it's them. If they grab it, they realize, oh, I'm seeing a reflection of myself.
And in a baby, a human baby, it's about 18 months to 2 years. It's around that kind of age that they develop self-awareness. In animals, some seemingly never develop it, but that might not be the case. So the rhesus monkeys had to be trained to understand how this experiment worked. So the monkeys were fixed into a special seat to ensure that they look forward at a mirror. A laser pointer was then aimed on boards adjacent to them that they could see in the mirror, and they were then sort of persuaded that it might, by being given food, that it's a good idea to touch the red dots. Then they switch it up. They put the red dot on the monkey's head, and the monkey touched the dot on its head, not in the mirror. So it was, to the scientists, it was showing that it was self-aware enough to understand that the dot's on it, not on another monkey that it's looking at. And this is interesting because previously there was another experiment with rhesus monkeys at the same Institute of Animal Science in China. And it was kind of controversial because the argument was that they just trained the monkeys to exhibit a conditioned response, that it would get food if it touched a red dot. Whereas on this one, they never trained the red dot on it. They only trained it to understand that a red dot needed touching.
Mm.
And it was able to understand that the red dot was on its head. And intriguingly, when they took it out of the cage, when they took it out of the chair and put it back into its cage, the trained monkeys, when put in front of a mirror with no dot, would do the kind of things that a human might do in front of a mirror. So they exposed their teeth and kind of checked them out. They combed their hair and looked through their legs to get an unusual angle on their genitals.
We've all done that.
We've all done that, obviously. So
you're doing it now, Burgess.
And there's not even any mirror. So this was the clincher for them, that the rhesus monkeys had been, they had self-awareness, but they'd also been trained to understand how a mirror works.
Yeah.
And this is the real crux of the study, that perhaps previously animals that we presumed aren't self-aware and don't have self-consciousness might just have not understood what a mirror is. And you need to train an animal to understand what a mirror is, and then they go, oh, that's me. And then they start looking at the genitals.
Does this really matter in terms of our like knowledge of the world, or is this just a bit of a pointless study?
Well, there's a sort of interesting and terrifying irony in this, that these are monkeys that are in captivity. They're being kept in cages. It's, to some people, animal cruelty to do these sort of things. But in turn, it's showing us that these animals have a far higher degree of intelligence than we might have imagined. So perhaps by doing these studies, in a way, the scientists are ensuring that they might not be able to do these kind of studies in the future, as we realize that these animals should be given far greater rights and autonomy and not be kept in cages, because that is cruel. Mm. Which wasn't something that we ran in the story, but was very much something that was going through my mind as I was reading the paper. There's a cruelty to it, especially when they realize that these animals are a lot more intelligent than we were giving them credit.
Sadly, yes.
So there's a bit of a downer on the end of that. Yeah. You can read more about it on wire.co.uk, as with all of the stories on the podcast this week. Our second story is a little more lighthearted, and we'll start it by playing you this. Now, if that doesn't bring back any memories, you're not old enough.
Nightmares, actually.
Nightmares. If it does, then sorry. Jeremy, tell us a little bit about what's been going on with Nokia this week.
Well, in what can only be described as some sort of PR coup, it has been, the internet is rife with rumour that the classic Nokia dumb phone, the 3310, will be making a comeback at the end of this month at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona.
This is now, the big tech trade show, yeah, where all of the latest technology is shown off. So it would be somewhat weird for Nokia to come along with a phone that was released, what, 20 years ago?
So this is the thing. No, it wouldn't be weird. And that's why this is such a great sort of non-story. And, you know, Lord knows, you know, we've done it too, because it is people are really interested in it. We've had the BBC phoning us up, asking us to comment on this story, for heaven's sake. Now, actually, Nokia has been producing dumb phones, you know, phones that just have a small LCD screen that are just there for making text and phone calls. They've been producing these phones periodically for years. I mean, I remember there was a big story a few years ago from World Congress when they brought out one of these dumb phones, and it was only £14. And now, of course, you've got the Freedom smartphone, which is only like £2.50 or something ridiculous. And yeah, so, these phones are getting increasingly cheap to produce, and there's always been a market for these dumb phones. We did a brilliant test a few years ago with a group of Chelsea pensioners to see whether they liked these new batch of dumb phones that were coming out. So these things have always been coming out. Nokia has continually been producing these. However, a rumour is going round that they are, you know, going to be reproducing or reimagining the classic 3310. And it is this story that has captured the imagination of the media and the internet.
Turns out the internet really, really loves nostalgia.
That's right. But there's no evidence for this whatsoever.
No.
You know, there's no evidence that they're actually going to do it. If I was at Nokia, I'd be scrabbling around like mad, rebranding something. So, for Christ's sake, are we launching a dumb phone? Right, call it the 3310, for Christ's sake. There's lots of people saying I haven't seen any evidence that it's actually going to happen. And it may well happen. And if so, great. But, I mean, why would you want, you can get a dumb phone down the high street today, no problem. You know, I don't know why we'd like to go back to that. I mean, there was a really good, well-designed dumb phone that came out, the Punct. Do you remember the Punct? The P-U-N-K-T?
No.
Now, this was a really lovely designed, industrial designed dumb phone, which was there to say, we're all regressing, and we want to regress with technology. We've got far too much technology. We're being far too bombarded with messages, with mobile phone calls, with emails, with web pages. And so this was meant to be the antidote to that, a really lovely, beautifully designed dumb phone that only let you make phone calls and take texts. And so there is an argument that we want to get back to the good old days, But similarly, there's also an argument to be made where we're forging ahead with AI and with VR and AR and all sorts of other developments in scientific developments and biological developments. And so, yes, you could say we're looking back, and this is an indicator that we're all sort of nostalgic about it. But I mean, we're all wired, and we're looking forward. You know, that's far more interesting.
Can I throw one argument into the mix of why you might want a dumb phone in this modern 2017 age?
Yeah,
I guess that around the world there's a lot of political conflicts, a lot of disagreements in places. So these sort of phones are very cheap. You would use basically for basic calling, texting, nothing really advanced. You could use them as a burner phone if you're doing something confidential or private or don't want to be caught by your spouse in a relationship. You could be using this sort of phone just as one that you throw away or to hide like political information, sensitive things that people might not agree with.
You could do that with any dumb phone. You don't need Nokia.
Generally dumb phones.
Battery power is a big thing, you know.
Right,
you know,
so these were the big bonuses of the 3310 and why it kind of holds this special place in people's imaginations. Yeah. The battery literally lasts for weeks.
Yeah, it did.
It was indestructible. I dropped mine in a bath and it still worked, we're getting there with modern smartphones now, but previously dropping your iPhone in some water was curtains and probably still is.
Yeah. I'm not sure you'd call it... This, the thing is, I don't know whether we're confusing nostalgia with design classic. I mean, I wouldn't say it is a beautiful phone. You recognised it immediately. You know, it is an iconic phone. It is has a tremendous amount of nostalgia attached to it. I don't know whether I would term it a design classic.
But
it would be
time,
a very cool thing if they did. If they have reproduced this, if you've got a new version of the 3310, then that's a really clever idea of them being able to market as much leverage as possible out of the fact that they're producing yet another dumb phone.
We'll see. Mobile Congress is a couple of weeks away. I'll be going along. If I do see it, I'll be staggered. Jeremy, you've convinced me that it probably doesn't even exist. So we'll move on to our...
Oh, God, it will now. Now you said that, it will be there.
It will definitely exist. Yeah. And you can read all about it on wired.co.uk. Our third story this week is about a YouTube star, perhaps bigger than any other, called PewDiePie. What's been going on, Matt?
First of all, do you two know who he is?
I do.
Do you know much about him? Or?
I know he gets paid a lot of money to talk about video games.
Okay, that's a good starting point.
I actually sounded jealous then. And then he gets paid a lot of money to talk about video games, doesn't he?
He does. For people who don't know of PewDiePie or never heard of him or don't even know what he does, he is a YouTuber. He's the biggest YouTube star that there is. He has 53 million subscribers and more than 14 billion views on his channel. And he's been YouTubing or vlogging, that's the right word, isn't it? Since April 2010, he has 9.71 million Twitter followers. 12 million on Instagram, was named in the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine, and basically is a gaming reviewer, or initially started out reviewing games, playing video games in a very sort of eccentric manner, and has probably really helped a lot of video games along in their development and their success. Yeah. And he's really just absolutely massive.
And he's made a huge amount of money, isn't he? Millions.
I think in 2016, sorry, it was estimated, we don't know for exactly what the figures are, but it was estimated he made around $14 million last year.
Jesus.
And that's a lot from advertising revenue, from his own books, his own range of clothes. I think he's got some socks.
He's got some socks.
Hoodies,
yeah.
All these sorts of things. And basically franchised himself and his personality and his brand.
Okay, so he's an internet celebrity, 27-year-old guy. Real name is Felix Kjellberg, I think.
The point being, though, is this is a big business, you know, making lots of money for him.
So, but something bad has happened.
So, at the beginning of this week, there was a report in the Wall Street Journal, and it's now gone around everywhere, but their investigation looked at some of his most recent videos and found that in 9 recently published ones, there were anti-Semitic messages, which were disguised as jokes, I guess, or could be interpreted as jokes, depending on his audience and the viewership. And basically, a couple of examples from this was a group of men holding up a sign that says "Death to all Jews." Another included a man dressed as Jesus with a banner or sign and saying, "Hitler did absolutely nothing wrong." I think they're pretty clear.
Wait a minute. Messages. In what context did these appear, these messages?
So it's him on the screen, and then in a little box out in the lower corner, there's video footage of these people doing what they're doing. And he paid them to do it through sort of a freelance job site.
Yeah, he did. A website called Fiverr, which is F-I-V-V-E-R. You can basically commission people to do things. And he said after he'd been called out that he had paid people from this platform to do stuff. And they were part of his show, his production, he says, and weren't intended to be anti-Semitic or even racist messages.
So let's just make something very clear. In pretty much any context, I think you could be that strong about it, a sign saying death to all Jews is offensive, is racist. A sign saying Hitler did absolutely nothing wrong is offensive and is racist.
Well, yes, I'm desperately trying to think of some sort of context where you could get away with that sort of ridiculous statements.
Okay, so let's go to the fallout from this, because it's been significant.
So he has lost basically a good portion of his business. We can't obviously put it into context, but in terms of monetary value. But Disney, which he had a contract with to produce shows as part of their Maker Studios agreement and how they produce shows through their channel, they dropped him from his shows with them after this first came out. And then YouTube followed suit by stopping his second series of his reality show that he does with them, and also removed him from their premium advertising revenue stream, basically.
So this is where the really big bucks for YouTube come. He'll still get revenue from every video view that goes through YouTube normal adverts that you get on videos, but he's, as you say, been cut from their premium service and also cut by Disney. The argument is that this has all gone way too far, but there's another argument. This is all very complicated.
Yeah, it's one of these areas that the message, I think, has been very clear, but the context is something that's very difficult for people to interpret. And I think that his argument in this, just to obviously give both sides of the view and make this as balanced as possible, is he says that he is a comedian and this is sort of part of his act. And he also continues to say that he isn't supporting any hateful attitudes, or in his view, he isn't supporting any hateful attitudes. And he's responded by saying that some of this has been taken out of context by the media. They're supposed to be these messages were supposed to be viewed within his audience, within his sphere, I guess. Mm. And basically, he said that, "I do strongly believe that you can make a joke about anything, but I also believe there's a right way and not the best way to do jokes about things." So he's sort of said, not fully apologised, I don't think, but he said he likes to push the boundaries and he considers himself a rookie comedian.
Okay.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is going to really hurt him financially, isn't it? I mean, drastically. So, you know, there are lessons to be learned here. But it'd be interesting to see how it changes his output over the next coming months, actually.
I think it will. And just for some more context on output of what he does, like I've scrolled for a few of his videos and watched a few of them in the last few days from just to get some more context and ideas around this. And he's very outspoken, he's very energetic, he's very well all his videos are very well edited and put together as like a production, as you would expect with a top YouTuber. Some other titles, video titles, and these are only a small few, I must say. He does produce 7-10 videos a week, some about gaming, some on other things like cringy kids on the internet, dank PewDiePie spicy memes, that's probably another story, drinking piss for views, so freaky I had to stop playing, Batman wants bat booty.
Okay.
And some of these are linked to video games. Some of them, they're all within their own context and different areas. But that's just a small hand-picked selection.
So the problem here is he's become incredibly, incredibly valuable and signed these deals with companies like Disney because of his personality, because he is marketable. And in a world of reputation being value, if your reputation is hit by something like this, then you risk losing your value.
You really do. And I think, as I said, he's said that some of this has been taken out of context, and I think it will wait. I think we have to wait to see in terms of what the actual reaction is, because I can't imagine he's going to stop making videos. I can't imagine he's going to stop producing stuff around what he's doing. There's been a lot of online support from certain sections of the internet for him. So it's one of these that is a case of, it's probably not going to stop anything, but these brands are obviously not happy with what he's produced, and there has been a backlash because of it.
And it's strange that you think that Disney would want to work with someone that made a video called Drinking Piss for Views. But finally, I think what I would say is the context argument is one that's often made when people do something that they then suddenly realize was actually massively offensive and that they shouldn't have done. They say, oh, it was taken out of context. I misspoke, or I'd been misquoted. If you go back and look at it, in what context are these kinds of jokes appropriate?
Or just in recent political arenas, you know, or just passed off as locker room banter or banter.
Yes.
And this is the shame, actually, is that, you know, when something like this happens, it'd be interesting to see how, yes, the from a PR point of view, the organisations have to distance themselves. Whether the public will, I don't know. You'll have to wait and see, because, you know, we've seen very recently in the highest possible level that saying things that are patently wrong, outrageous and offensive, and just brazening it out doesn't necessarily mean that public support will fall away.
And in a similar vein, he has a very, very loyal and big fan base that probably won't be dissuaded from following him by anything necessarily.
I think they're called the Bro Army.
There we go. And just take a look at the comments under posts on Twitter. This has been debated around the echo chamber of social media, good and proper, over the last couple of days. And it's interesting to see the level of vociferous support that he's receiving. And it will be interesting to see, as the numbers tot up over the coming months, how good his support is and how...
And whether that will lure in, you know, different advertisers, different, people who want to, brands that want to collaborate with him.
A cautionary tale for anyone looking to make millions on YouTube. Our final story of the week. In the latest issue of Wired, which is out now, we take a look at the major existential threats facing civilization. It's no small topic, from asteroids to tyrannical leaders. We met the Center for the Study of Existential Risk and the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence. Both teams are made up of academics, lawyers, scholars, and philosophers of the highest order, and they assess the biggest threats facing Earth and how we can save ourselves from them. To lighten the mood, I thought it would be fun to end the show with a rundown of the top 10, in no particular order. So let's get going. At 1, artificial intelligence takes over the world.
At 2, pandemic disease threatens humanity.
At 3, AI-powered weapons seize control and form a militia.
At 4, nuclear conflict brings about the end of civilization.
Coming in at number 5, extreme climate change triggers collapse in infrastructure.
Coming in at number 5.
It's all gone a bit top of the pops.
Okay. Right, Bob, because an asteroid impacts, destroys all traces of life.
That's 7. No. Life as we know it proves a complex simulation.
Number 8, food shortages cause mass starvation.
At number 9, a true vacuum sucks up the universe at the speed of light.
At number 10, a tyrannical leader undermines global stability. I'm kind of underlining that one with my voice.
Please tell me we do have some sort of Pick of the Pops Take Two music going on underneath this. There better be.
Yeah, here we go. I'll try and look it out and get the licensing deal for it. So I think this is a fascinating topic. I mean, what we've also done in the feature is ranked the threats by their likely date and their priority. So something like an asteroid hitting the Earth could happen, but we've got a fairly good idea that it's not going to happen for the next X thousand years, because we've got them all, we think, tracked.
Yeah.
Whereas a tyrannical leader undermining global stability, you know, it could happen.
That doesn't seem very likely either.
No, and it turns out these groups had meetings after a certain leader was elected to office in recent months. But one of the ones that really caught my eye was the one at number 9. A true vacuum sucks up the universe at the speed of light. This is probably the least likely one to happen, but if you're going to get existential, you might as well go the whole hog and get as existential as you probably can. So the threat of Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin might seem a little more tangible, but this is the idea that the entire universe could be sucked into nothingness at the speed of light. At any moment.
That sounds absolutely ridiculous.
I've got so much work to do.
Yeah.
It would be really helpful, actually.
It happened. savors true vacuum. So for the past decade, there's been conjecture that particle collisions in particle accelerators, we're looking at you, CERN, and others, could trigger a reaction that would change all matter and the laws of physics. So some academics have argued that what we previously thought to be vacuums actually contain particles, and that the universe contains one true vacuum of absolute nothingness. So this true vacuum, they say, is lying dormant in a meta-stable state, but through a process of vacuum decay, it could suck the entire universe in at the speed of light and get rid of everything ever.
Oh my God.
Yes. This is what these people do for a living. They worry about this stuff. So, as I said, right now it's in a metastable state, so it's dormant, it's sleeping. But particle accelerators, the argument goes, could effectively disturb it and turn it on. And were that to happen? Well, no, quicker than that. Yeah. As I said, we asked our experts to rate the likelihood of these kind of threats on a likelihood scale. This one receives a likely date of technically now, or, well, technically quicker than now, and a threat priority of very low. But an interesting thought experiment, nonetheless.
Well, I'm worried about it now. I wasn't before.
Yes. Matt Burgess, yours is somewhat more earnest.
Yeah, and slightly more, well, not closer to home, but just more relatable, I guess, and doesn't involve the really complex science and quantum physics and everything like that.
Yeah.
Food shortages. The world's population is growing if you live in a city, particularly in some of the biggest countries in the world. The UK, London is massive and still growing. You think to China, they're creating giant global mega cities and absolutely huge populous areas. We need more food, and getting food to cities and even rural places is getting harder, and the populations are growing, and we're gonna probably struggle going forwards. And by 2050, we're supposed to have 9.6 billion people on the planet here at Earth. I think there's about 7 billion now at the moment, 6, 7 billion.
Yeah, getting towards 7 or 8 now, I think. So there's a need for food production to increase, the argument goes.
Yeah.
Global warming's going to be an issue.
And the priority is high, basically. Food prices are rising, and they're going to set to rise by around 2020, or a high, sharp rise around then, because of the growing population and the amount of food that we're producing and how we can get it to different places. Global warming is causing issues with production and how we produce foods. And waste is also a big problem as well. Even though we're talking about food shortages, like Western countries waste a hell of a lot of food. And this is just one of these big problems that is going to probably keep growing, but one that if we don't keep a check on it, we're not going to realize this true scale of it, because privileged, lucky people like us get to live in a society where food is abundant, where we throw away far too much. But when you consider developing nations, there is so little food to go around, it's horrifying.
What I've always found quite striking about this issue is that it's an issue that doesn't necessarily need to exist. So there's enough food to feed everyone in the world, and more than. There's probably enough food to feed the population of 9.6 billion, but it's the distribution, and it's the way it's shared out isn't equitable. So it's a logistics problem, and it's a sort of a problem of capitalist wealth distribution, which is a whole other thing. So just as a little example of this, farmers that grow beans, as in long beans, what's the right word for them?
Runner beans?
Runner beans, yeah. for supermarkets in Britain, had to have them of a certain size to fit into those little plastic packets that supermarkets are obsessed with wrapping all of our food in. The supermarket said the packets need to be this big to fit into one of our crates that goes on the supermarket shelf so that we can fit in this many, which is the number that we need to fit. But the beans are actually longer than that. So the farmers were growing them to the length that they naturally grow to, and then cutting them to size and just throwing away the waste, which is perfectly edible bean.
Yes.
But it just never makes it, which is why these trimmed beans are of a certain size. And a sort of an entrepreneur activist got wind of this news that tons and tons and tons of beans were just being thrown out for no good reason, and went, oi, supermarkets. So they changed the size of their packaging.
Yeah.
So now when you go and buy beans in a shrink wrap in Tesco's, they're longer.
Okay.
It seems ridiculous.
Yes, it does.
And that's just one example. And technology is an activism are kind of here to save us in some way. So the idea that you could use advanced sensors to improve crop yields, you can biologically alter grain so that it's more disease resistant, it can grow in drought.
You can grow meat.
Yeah,
to the lab. You know, this is the thing. The other area they're going into is sort of like traditional farming, you know, might be a way that, you know, they don't want to go down. They might want to go down in the lab route.
Yeah, yep. And to end it on that's more of a positive note to end it on. Like, while we are going to have food shortage problems and distribution problems, there are many ways that are being devised and thought up of to actually try and solve this sort of issue and all the issues that we actually talk about in this feature in the magazine. And there are a lot of threats, but I think there are also a lot of very intelligent people working on them.
So I want my steak grown in a lab and then delivered to me in Cornwall via Amazon Prime drone. There you go. There's a distribution solution as well.
It's a future we can all get behind. Rapid steak delivery. Rapid synthetic steak delivery. The feature is Earth Guardians Are Here to Save Us. It's in the issue of Wired magazine, which is out right now. You can read some of it online, but do pick up the magazine. It's a beautiful thing. That's it for this week. We will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.